From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People from the United States are rarely allowed a visa to go to North Korea. And if you're an American reporter, it's even tougher. The journalist Barbara Demick managed to get into North Korea in 2005, but of course she was always accompanied by two men in dark suits, her minders. In the book she wrote a few years ago about North Korea, she describes how the men rarely made eye contact with her. And at some point she began to wonder things about them. Did they really believe the elaborate propaganda about the country? Did they really love their leader like they all said they did? And she also wondered what it was like when they came home from work, or did they have enough food? Demick is coming to Utah this week, and today she's joining us to talk about the book she's written to get at those questions, the story of some of the North Korean citizens and their ordinary lives. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the acclaimed book she wrote about North Korea a few years ago, the journalist Barbara Demick explains how incredibly difficult it is to report about North Korea. Getting in is hard enough, but if you do manage it, you're never left alone to wander around or talk to people. Demick explains that whether at the headquarters of the CIA or at universities around the country, most people analyze North Koreans from afar. But Demick says she wanted to get closer to, as she put it in the book, discern what was behind those blank faces you see in photographs and on television. At some point, Demick realized that the only real way to do it was to talk to the people who had left, the defectors. So her book tells the stories of six North Korean citizens over the course of 15 years. Barbara Demick is coming to Utah later this week. It's giving us an opportunity to talk about the stories in her book. It's called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. You can join the conversation if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Barbara Demick is the Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Her book, Nothing to Envy, was a finalist for the National Book Award. She's won numerous awards for her reporting on both North Korea and Sarajevo, which is the subject of her first book, Lagavina Street. That book was recently released, by the way, we should say, with a new preface and final chapter and epilogue. Demick is joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Barbara Demick, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with kind of a really powerful image and a story in your book, Nothing to Envy. And the image is this satellite photo that you include at the beginning of the first chapter. It's of North and South Korea at night. And South Korea is dotted throughout, you know, by light. But it's so striking. North Korea is just blank. And I wanted you to talk about that darkness, if you would, because that's how you begin the book. Because you say at night, you know, entire villages in North Korea just kind of vanish.
That's right. I mean, North Korea is really located in the middle of the greatest economic miracle of our time. China, South Korea, Japan are booming, and East Asia is full of light. And North Korea is a black hole. When you look at this satellite photo, you see only darkness because they don't have electricity at night in most of the country. And I picked that image because it's also a very powerful metaphor. It's a black hole in what we know about the world. This is a place with no internet access, very few foreigners, you know, no freedom of communications, no free open telephone lines. And so it is a black hole in every which way.
You say that, and this was interesting, you said that there are a lot of North Koreans that you talk to who said they kind of learned to love the darkness.
Well, North Korea is also a place totally lacking in privacy.
Yeah.
And you know, people are monitored, you know, every step of the day. They're monitored in their homes and their workplaces. They don't dare speak freely. They don't even dare to think freely. But at night, there is some privacy, and people can go out and have a conversation. They can meet their boyfriend or their girlfriend. They can move around unobserved. And this was the case with the people in my book, Miran and her boyfriend Jun Sang, who had actually don't get any ideas here. They had a very chaste, innocent relationship, yeah. But for reasons of their class backgrounds, it was difficult for them to be seen together, and they took advantage of this moment of privacy.
I want to have you read a moment from that story, if you would. So Miran and Jun Sang, they're walking at night, and at first, as you say in the book, they walk in silence. But eventually, when they sort of get out of earshot, they can have a real conversation. Read this section for us, if you would.
That's right. Okay. The night sky in North Korea is a sight to behold. It might be the most brilliant in Northeast Asia, the only place spared the coal dust, Gobi Desert sand, and carbon monoxide choking the rest of the continent. In the old days, North Korean factories contributed their share to the cloud cover, but no longer. No artificial lighting competes with the intensity of the stars etched into its sky. The young couple would walk through the night, scattering ginkgo leaves in their wake. What did they talk about? Their families, their classmates, books they had read, whatever the topic, it was endlessly fascinating. Years later, when I asked the girl about the happiest memories of her life, she told me of those nights. This is not the sort of thing that shows up in satellite photographs. Whether in CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, or in the East Asian studies departments of a university, people usually analyze North Korea from afar. They don't stop to think that in the middle of this black hole, in the middle of this bleak, dark country where millions have died of starvation, there is also love.
When did you come up with the idea at first that you wanted to write a piece that didn't necessarily analyze policy about North Korea, but said something more intimate, more personal? When did you first start thinking about that?
You know, I think it was from the moment I started covering North Korea, which was 2001. Everything I had read about North Korea was about the nuclear weapons programs, about the Korean War, about Kim Il-sung's family. It was all geopolitics. But I had very little idea of what it was like to be a North Korean. I had never read a real first-person account of North Korean lives. And I became quite obsessed with the details of everyday life, how you cooked your dinner, where you went on a date, what you did for fun, you know, how you met your husband or your wife or raised your children. And I really wanted the sense of what it was like to be a North Korean. I think, you know, also because it was so difficult for me to get into North Korea. And, you know, even when you were there, you couldn't see much. I became very obsessed about the details of everyday life. I think for journalists, if you tell a journalist they're not allowed to go someplace or not allowed to speak to people, they become obsessed. Yeah. So, you know, I wanted every little bit. I wanted to know what the shoelaces looked like. And so I think this was always in my mind while I was reporting on North Korea.
Did you think there was, at some point before you struck upon the idea to tell the story from those who had left, did you figure at some point maybe naively that, you know, maybe I can do this from inside?
I think I figured that out pretty quickly because although I didn't have that much access to North Korea itself, I had access to North Korean people. There were a lot of defectors living in Seoul, and they were often quite lonely. When the first North Koreans started coming south in the early 90s, they were kind of like rock stars. It was like, oh, my God, North Korean defectors. But there were enough of them by the time I got there that people weren't really that interested in hearing what they had to say. And I guess because I was frustrated and obsessed, was fascinated with everything. So it was almost a therapeutic relationship between me, the author, and the people in my book, who I'm still quite friendly with. Because I really wanted to understand who they were. And I felt that even though I couldn't get into their country, I could get into their heads because I had the time and I had the interest. And we would talk for hours and hours and hours and hours and until I felt I understood them well enough that I could answer their questions for them.
You know, it's interesting that, for example, Miran, one of the first stories you tell in the book, and you say in the book that you know, I guess most people would figure that someone coming from a place like North Korea, you know, which is so repressive, that they would be retiring, you know, or passive. But it doesn't seem like that was necessarily the case with maybe it was with some, but Miran in particular, as you say, she wasn't very demure. But what I wonder, what are these defectors? Do they have a common characteristic about them?
Well, the people I picked, if they had something in common that I was looking for, was this sense of being born yesterday, or at least reborn at the time they escaped from North Korea. They were full of awe about the world. I mean, these were the modern-day Rip Van Winkles. They had, you know, grown up in this, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but in this black hole of a country, not knowing anything of the outside world. You know, maybe a glimpse of a foreign movie or a book, but, you know, really very, very little of our world. And so they were so full of curiosity and so animated about life. They weren't as cynical as other people I interviewed. So I really loved interviewing them. And Miran, the young woman in the book, well, she starts as a teenager in the book, was a great storyteller herself. Mm. She told her own life story with great animation, and I think nobody had asked her about this much detail of her life and how she met her first boyfriend and about her sisters and her brother. She was, you know, kind of this Pride and Prejudice family with four girls and one boy, and she was the youngest girl who should have been a boy and, you know, faced a lot of discrimination for being a girl and for being from a bad class background. Yeah. And, you know, all this information came spilling out of her in a very narrative fashion. So that helped a lot. And she was just very animated. And Mrs. Kim, another person in my book who defected in her 50s, you know, was somebody who, having gotten out of North Korea and having lived in great deprivation and having seen much of her family die of starvation, I mean, she had such joie de vie to be alive and able to travel and taste new foods. And so I really enjoyed these people's energy.
It's interesting. If you think about Dr. Kim, too, she has a moment in the experience, a difficult time adapting at first, feeling, you know, this sense of guilt. You even say she contemplated suicide, has these regrets, and things change eventually. But one thing you write about in the book, which was interesting, is kind of the character of some of these defectors, is how they're often difficult people. That they were pushed into leaving, you say, because in some ways a lot of them didn't really fit in at home.
That's right. That's right. People leave North Korea for all different reasons. But most of them are not directly political. Somebody like Dr. Kim was always very loyal to the regime. She had no intention of being a defector. And in fact, she ended up crossing the river into China only to find food and with every intention of coming back. And once she got to China, she realized that her whole life was a lie. She was not a discontent, but yet she was a difficult person. She had married and divorced very quickly. She didn't have custody of her son. She is quite a self-righteous person. She didn't want to bend the rules. And although she was very loyal to the Workers' Party, that's the North Korean equivalent of the Communist Party, she was not good at taking orders that she didn't respect. And, you know, I guess people you meet even in a place like North Korea fit into personality traits that we recognize in the United States. I mean, there was another woman, the daughter of one of the true believers, who also just, you know, hated marching, hated reciting propaganda, hated doing all the things that was required of being a North Korean citizen. And, you know, she probably would have been a rebel wherever she grew up. Hmm.
Your description of the landscape there is very, really interesting, because at one point in the book you describe Chongjin, where this is where Miran lived, and I guess where most of them lived in the book. And you describe it as strikingly beautiful, but you say that the color palette seemed limited. that it was in some kind of strange way, kind of devoid of color in some way. Do you know what? How do you describe that? How do you explain that?
Well, the North Korea, I mean, obviously, it's beautiful in that it has, you know, very striking mountains, and there's, you know, the greenery, there's evergreens, there's a beautiful blue ocean in Chungjin, which is near the beach. But you don't see that much artificial color.
Yeah.
There's no advertising, for example. So the only reds you'll see are in the propaganda signs, which are usually red on white, and that dominates the red palette. Mm. And even the greens are not as vivid as they would be in other parts of Asia, where there's less denuded mountains. The North Korean landscape has been hurt for years by excess use of fertilizers, by people chopping down trees. So there's a starkness to it that I think lends itself to these black and white ink brush drawings. And that's certainly my memory of North Korea, especially getting outside of Pyongyang. Mm.
I want to ask you about the title of the book, Nothing to Envy. It comes from, it appears, and certainly I imagine it appears all over the place in these signs, but it's kind of a lyric, I guess. It comes from a song, an anthem that you hear all over the place, I suppose, in North Korea. We have a little brief section of this, I think, and I wanted to say something about this idea, as well as the song, of Nothing to Envy.
That's right. Well, it's a bit of a pun at the same time. The song is called We Have Nothing to Envy in the World, and it's a song that's sung mostly by kindergarten students. It's actually the words, We Have Nothing to Envy in the World, are often on the archways above kindergartens in North Korea. Mm. And it's what North Koreans are taught. We have nothing to envy in the world. We grow up under the loving embrace of Kim Il-sung and then his son, Kim Jong-il, and we're all family in the Workers' Party, and we have nothing to envy in the world. And this is the underlying myth of North Korea, one might say the underlying lie, because all the people in my book grow up believing this, that, you know, okay, South Korea is richer, but they're under the thumb of the American imperialists, and they're not free people, and the United States and Europe are full of violence and race riots, and the Chinese are starving, so we live in the best place there is. And this is why the regime has had to keep the North Koreans hermetically sealed, because if they get out for a minute and see how people live elsewhere, even in poorer parts of China across the river, they will realize that they have a lot to envy. And one by one, the people in my book realize that this saying has been a lie. Mm. And that's why I picked it as the title.
Here's just a moment from that song, Nothing to Envy. You know, I guess it's hard to relate to a condition where people are so isolated from the outside world, where they have nothing to compare their lives to. That was striking, I have to say, in the book. And you mentioned Dr. Kim and the experience, the kind of, I don't know if this was the particular epiphany, but there's this moment where she finds refuge in a Chinese village in a house, and she sees on the ground this bowl which has white rice in it, with scraps of meat, which would be an incredible luxury, but, you know, the farmers had just sort of set that out for the dog. And that was an incredible sort of powerful moment for her, a realization. This woman, Dr. Kim, who was a doctor, who was starving herself, and everyone else in her family was starving. And here in this poor village, in this poor, you know, farmhouse, I guess, people were eating, imagine this, white rice and scraps of meat.
That's right.
Powerful.
That's right. As she said, she realized at that moment that dogs in China ate better than doctors in North Korea. Mm. And what was amazing was that she had just crossed the river. This is the one who was so loyal and insisted she would go back. And, you know, she left because she was starving and she had some family in China and she thought she might be able to borrow some money or food and go back home. And she had just come across the river. Defectors usually walk across the Tumen River, so she was still soaking wet. Mm. And maybe 30 minutes in China, and she realized, as she said, that my whole life was a lie. Everything I was ever taught was a lie. And she knew then that she would never go back to North Korea, and she didn't.
Barbara Demick is with us. She's the Beijing bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, the author of the book Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. She's going to be in Utah this week on Thursday for a lecture at Brigham Young University. The event, we should say, begins at 11 a.m. It's free, open to the public. You can go to our website for the details, KUER.org/Radio West. You can join us if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Barbara Demick is joining us. She's coming to Utah this week, and so we're taking the opportunity to talk to her about her extraordinary reporting on North Korea. Demick has been following the lives of ordinary North Korean citizens over the past 15 years or so. She's written a book called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to spend a little bit more time with Mi Ran because she's such a great character. She has this rebellious streak, like some do, and she's reacting to these restrictions for women that I guess I'm not sure why I was surprised about this. I figured it's pretty repressive for everyone, but the restrictions for women were interesting. They sound not unlike what you might hear about in a country like Saudi Arabia, for example.
That's right, and you know, going back a century. In Korea, women of the middle and upper class were covered. They wore big baskets over their heads like burqas until the early 20th century. So that there were a lot of repressive traditions regarding women. North Koreans are still very, very modest. Women can't go sleeveless. Well, recently there have been shots of women wearing short skirts on TV, but that's quite scandalous. Very, very conservative standards. And especially under Kim Jong-il, there were a lot of rules about how women had to wear their hair, what they were allowed or not allowed to do. And one of the prohibitions that's been on and off in North Korea, it seems to be more off now, but it may still be on in some places, that women weren't allowed to ride bicycles. It was considered somehow unseemly, or it would, you know, ruin your virginity. And in a place where people don't have cars and the public transportation is sporadic, it was a big deal not to ride a bicycle. And Mi Ran was, you know, in that sense, an early feminist, in that she was saying, well, you know, I have places to go. I'm going to ride my bicycle, even though people will be yelling at me. It's a funny thing because the women in North Korea are now the ones who are making the money in the private market.
Yeah.
But there have always been a lot of rules and standards that have kept them back.
Mi Ran and Jun Song, they have kind of a meet cute at a movie house, which is kind of the cultural center. Mi Ran really kind of finds comfort in the cinema. And we should explain, as you do in the book, movies are, you know, were the right kind of movies anyway, were a big deal in North Korea.
That's right. And Kim Jong-il loved the cinema. In fact, for a while, he was running the film studios himself, and he wrote a book on the art of cinema. You know, he saw cinema as supporting the propaganda message of the regime, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't purely entertainment. But every little town had a movie theater, and people would go to the movies, and it might be propaganda, but there was still romance and drama, and both Miran and her boyfriend loved the movies, so that's where they met.
Yeah. Miran's father, Tae-woo, it's interesting because history, he fought with South Korea in the war. Just a few weeks, though, before the end of the war, he finds himself a prisoner in North Korea when his medical unit is captured.
That's right. There were many South Koreans who were captured in North Korea. And at the end of the war, when the foreigners were eventually repatriated, the South Koreans were never allowed to go home because, well, there was a shortage of men. Many men had been killed. There was a shortage of male labor. So they remained. They became North Koreans. I mean, these were one people speaking the same language.
Yeah.
They were allowed to marry, but they were always considered a hostile element of society, very unreliable. And this was her family secret. In fact, she didn't know till she was in her late teens that her father was from South Korea and had fought with the South Korean military and had been, in fact, a prisoner of war. That was a big family secret. But North Koreans had a hierarchy based on their loyalty to the regime.
Yeah.
And she was considered tainted blood.
Yeah.
Because she came from this South Korean family. And that made her somebody who Jun-sung, who came from a higher caste family, had to avoid because he was a brilliant student and very ambitious and had the chance to go to university in Pyongyang, but he couldn't be seen with a girl of this tainted blood.
But the stakes for him are so high. I mean, his you point out he wasn't cowardly, but he was being a dutiful son. And his parents were ethnic Koreans, but they were born in Japan, and they decided to go to North Korea and realized probably wasn't the best idea, but there's no going back. And so the stakes for him are high, which made me think about those little walks they were having in the dark.
They were incredibly risky. Yeah, they were taking a lot of risks by being seen together. Although he was of higher status than she, the fact that he had relatives in Japan made him also untrustworthy.
Yeah.
And so he had to watch himself much more carefully than somebody from a purely loyal family who had this higher ranking. And that was a large reason for their secrecy and a reason that they weren't going to get married.
Mm. You call the caste system in North Korea as rigid as India's. Basically three classes, you say. There's the core class, there's the wavering class, and then there's the hostile class. So it's all related on just how loyal you are. Yeah.
How loyal you are to the Kim family. That's purely it. And of course, a place like Pyongyang and the universities in Pyongyang are reserved for the core class. These are all the most loyal people in the country. But you get to someplace like Chungjin, and especially to the countryside, and you have more of these people from the wavering if you're in the hostile class, you're probably in a prison camp. But, you know, from the lower elements.
No moving up, you say, in this system.
There's some moving up, but it's much easier to move down.
Right.
Than to move up. It's very easy to move down. You can, you could put your cup on a picture of Kim Il-sung in the newspaper, and you could be down very quickly. You know, you could make a little joke about the leadership or, you know, get arrested for starting a private business, and you could find yourself down very quickly.
If I'm in North Korea, do I know what class I belong? I guess I know if I'm in Pyongyang, but you're never told which
you know, you're never exactly told. And there's, you know, the legend has it that there's a warehouse where everybody's records are kept, and there are a lot of files in every work unit. There's a party secretary who's keeping your file and knows, you know, something more about you than you may know about yourself. But you don't, you're not like I'm a member of, you know, civil service rank 19. You don't know specifically where you are.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Janice. Janice is with us in Provo. Janice, hi.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yes, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you great.
Okay, first of all, I wanted to thank the author for the wonderful book. I really couldn't put it down once I started it. And I have a couple questions. One is there any plans to translate the book into Korean so that it might possibly circulate more widely and maybe even surreptitiously in North Korea? And then my second question is, did Miran ever find out how she got into that, whatever it was, that graduate program where she got further training as a teacher?
On the first question, yes, there are plans to translate it into Korean. It hasn't happened yet. Did Miran find out? She did not, but there was an assumption that the job as a teacher had become less and less desirable. And so they allowed in people who were not of as high status, but she was quite surprised to get in. And also her family had done well.
Yeah.
Although she was of this tainted blood, her father was a very careful person who never talked about the past. One of her sisters had married well into a military family. And so they were, I think, gradually bringing themselves up.
Miran was pretty, which didn't hurt. It didn't always
didn't
help,
hurt,
I suppose,
didn't
but it didn't hurt, I guess. That may have had something to do with it too, do you think?
Yeah, she was pretty and she was loyal. And her family, you know, despite her father's tainted blood, really was quite a loyal family. She was in no way a dissident. I mean, she was a rebel against some of the restrictions for women and a free thinker, but she was in no way hostile to the regime. And over time, I mean, largely through her father's discretion, he was somebody who never drank and never talked about the past and, you know, avoided any kind of bitterness. It was only when he became very old that he started singing South Korean songs. You know, he tried to obliterate this stain on their family.
Yeah.
And her mother was very ambitious and hardworking. So, you know, I would say they were coming up in status.
Yeah. You talk about how the truth, when the siblings did find out that their father was South Korean, must have been devastating, given the way the North Korean version of history portrays South Koreans. That must have been pretty hard to take.
That's right. That's right. Well, they first found out that he was from South Korea, but they thought, I mean, there was no South and North Korea for a while, but they thought originally that he had enlisted on the communist side,
right,
and so that he was a loyalist. But when they found out he fought on the other side, I mean, it would be like the equivalent of finding out that your father was Nazi. You know, they were devastated by it.
Talk a little bit more about Cheongjin, this city that, as you say, had a bad reputation even by North Korean standards. And this other character that emerges that you write about, Song Hee-suk, Mrs. Song, who works in this clothing factory, which is an extraordinary story in of itself. She works in a clothing factory that has no fabric and there's no thread and there's no electricity, but you still had to go to work every day.
That's right. That's right. This was part of the North Korean system. You know, you belong, as in China in the past, to a work unit, and you have to go to your work, whether there's work or not. So at Mrs. Song's factory, they ran out of fabric, they ran out of electricity, they had nothing. So they would go out and they would pick up bits of scrap metal. They would sometimes pick up dog droppings for fertilizer. It was very degrading work, but that was the system.
Mm.
And it was part of the reason that people were starving much longer than they should have been, because they weren't even allowed to go out and, you know, search for food in the woods themselves. They had to report to these non-paying, nothing jobs.
What I found so powerful about that story was, you know, she's in a city where there's pretty much no food. I mean, her husband dies, she loses her only son, her mother-in-law dies. And even through that, she explains that by sort of the way she understands it is that she herself had somehow failed. That's how powerful
right.
the propaganda, I suppose,
that's
was.
That's right. That's right. And because, you know, as the food supply ran out, the propaganda was stepped up, and this became the arduous march, and you were being tested like Kim Il-sung when he was fighting the Japanese. You know, he had to persevere and there was no food and, you know, you were responsible, especially as a woman, to feed your family. So it was all your fault. And if your family starved, you were letting down the regime. And she believed that till the very end. I mean, I don't want to be a plot spoiler here, but she would have never defected from North Korea. She was kind of kidnapped by her own daughter. It's a bit of a saga, and you can find out in the book, but she was kind of kidnapped by her own daughter into leaving and to seeing what life was like on the other side. And I picked her in particular because one of the, you know, very justified criticisms of this kind of book is you're writing about defectors, and of course they're discontents, and they're going to tell you the more negative aspects about the country, and, you know, how can you do a fair profile based on these people.
Yeah.
But she and Dr. Kim, you know, again, had both been very, very loyal. And they were, you know, kind of accidental defectors. So I felt that their views, you know, were quite valid because Mrs. Song could tell you the good and the bad, and there was good, too.
Yeah. Barbara Demick is with us. Her book is called Nothing to Envy: Ordinary Lives in North Korea. She's going to be in Utah this week on Thursday for a lecture at Brigham Young University. The event begins at 11 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. If you need details, go to our website, kuer.org/Radio West. Janice, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST if you'd like to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Barbara Demick. We're talking about her book, Nothing to Envy: Ordinary Lives in North Korea. She's coming to Utah this week on Thursday, in fact, at Brigham Young University. She's going to be talking about North Korea. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to ask you about... You write about how information starts to seep into North Korea. You write about Miran being one of the first, her family being one of the first to leave North Korea, which I find kind of extraordinary because you point out in the decades and decades before her family left, there had been, it's amazing they have an actual number here, 923 North Koreans who had fled to South Korea. And if you compare that, as you do in the book, to the 21,000 who were leaving East Germany, you know, to escape into the West every year, that's a pretty remarkable number.
It was very, very low. And that's really a tribute to the success of the North Korean propaganda, because it wasn't impossible to get out. There's 800 miles of rivers forming the western border of North Korea with China. But people were convinced that they had it much better and that they were lucky to be North Korean, that they had nothing to envy. And for a while, it was true until maybe the early 1980s. North Korea was almost as prosperous or more prosperous than South Korea, and certainly more prosperous than China during the Great Leap Forward, when millions of Chinese were starving. Some ethnic Koreans had escaped from northeastern China into North Korea. In fact, that was Dr. Kim's family.
Yeah.
And so they grew up thinking, well, the Chinese really have it bad. The Chinese are starving, but we have the better form of socialism. But then, you know, things changed by the early 1990s.
Yeah. And as you say, the traffic sort of flows both ways. North Koreans pour into China, and then Chinese goods start pouring into North Korea. And you've got lots of, you know, food and clothing. But then books and magazines come and DVDs. And you write about these South Korean movies that make their way by way of DVDs into the city.
That's right.
And soap operas.
South Korean soap operas. Yeah. You know, DVDs have been a big threat to North Korea because they have, you know, they have images and they're cheap. We can buy DVDs for $1 or $2 in Beijing. You can buy them for a few cents at the North Korean border. And Chinese-made DVD players are very cheap, and they're small. You can smuggle them. So this illegal traffic in DVDs has been devastating to North Korea because people are seeing what lifestyles are like elsewhere.
Yeah.
And when DVDs come in, say a South Korean soap opera, what people are interested in the North Koreans is the kitchen in the background. They're looking, you know, beyond the scene at the kitchen table where the couple are having the fight, and they're looking at the rice cooker and the refrigerator and the dishwasher and the food, the bowl of fruit, you know, all these luxuries that were unknown in North Korea. And that has been one of the factors that's eroded the hold of the North Korean government, because people realize there's a lot to envy. And you know, it's funny, when foreign films are admitted into North Korea, like for the Pyongyang Film Festival, which I attended a few years ago, they'll bring in period pieces. You know, history is okay, but they don't want North Koreans seeing that modern kitchen.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. David is in Provo. David, welcome.
Yes, I wonder if electronic media will open up the North Korean society. What are the chances of the whole propaganda system breaking down?
In a country that has effectively has no internet, though, still, I guess, Barbara Demick?
And that's why they've kept out the internet. I mean, this is the question that you're asking. Because in order for North Korea to go forward, it needs modern communications. It needs the internet. Everybody uses the internet now, but they don't have the internet. Only a very few people in the elite are allowed to use what's called an intranet. They bought an online dictionary some years ago, or encyclopedia some years ago, for academic use. And if you're in academia, you can search in there. Some people are allowed in government will be allowed to send emails out of the country, but they can't search the internet freely. And I think the North Koreans have seen what's happening in China and the effect of the Arab Spring, and they're very nervous about the internet.
Mm.
But you know, you can't have modern business without modern communications. And you know, it's just the last few years that they've gotten mobile telephones in Pyongyang. So you can see how far behind they are.
Mm. David, thanks very much, by the way. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. I guess you're probably thinking a bit about Sarajevo these days. I mean, you had to you rewrote the preface and final chapter and epilogue to the book Lagavna Street, and this is where you talk about this, write about this. It's very similar in many ways to some of the stories you write about in Nothing to Envy. It's about ordinary people and going through
The case with Sarajevo, which was my first big foreign posting in the 1990s, you know, I wanted to show through the stories of real people, you know, what it was like when a fairly modern European city implodes in this horrible ethnic warfare, you know, at a time that the world was supposed to be in a burst of peace. It was right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the time we were talking about the peace dividend, and suddenly the city of Sarajevo was under medieval siege warfare. But I think the techniques were the same, were to take people in Sarajevo who were very unfamiliar to Americans and tell stories. And it was very similar. There's a teenage girl who's lost her parents and a young couple and a couple who are separated. But I've also, I've used this technique a lot to try to bring in readers who aren't necessarily interested in international news, or if they're interested, don't know how to relate to people who, in fact, might be a lot like themselves.
Well, I guess it's about taking in Nothing to Envy, for example. I guess you did something like 100 different interviews over the course of the time, and I guess it's just piecing together enough of the elements to create a really dramatic narrative. That's the way in, I suppose, for you.
That's right, and I mean this is in getting people to relate.
Yeah.
To the characters or the people in the book. In the case of Sarajevo, this was, okay, we had these complicated Serbo-Croatian Bosnian names. The joke was always that Clinton should import vowels to Bosnia to make the names easier. But my readers couldn't relate to these people in Sarajevo whose names they couldn't pronounce. In the case of North Korea, the North Koreans were completely demonized by the foreign press, or at least dehumanized. You only saw North Koreans as robots, mm-hmm. marching, chanting oaths to the leadership. And there was now North Koreans tend to be the stock bad guys in films. Yeah. There's this, you know, impersonal quality to how they're portrayed. It's almost like the worst cliches about Asians are applied to the North Koreans. They're inscrutable. They're cold. Blah blah blah. You know, all this junk. That's just not true. And you know, I think the thing that I've learned as a foreign correspondent, and this sounds like such a cliche, I'm embarrassed to say it, but you know, people are kind of the same everywhere.
Yeah.
They care about their lovers and their kids and their aging parents, and they're more similarities than differences. So when you get down to that street level to tell their stories, they're very compelling.
What's Lagavna Street like these days? You went back not so long ago.
Lagavna Street is lovely. It's a multi-ethnic street in the middle of Sarajevo. You know, everybody in Europe is saying that multi-ethnic Bosnia is dead and that they've moved into their ethnic enclaves. But on this street, which I wrote about during the war, many Serbs have remained and people are still living together, you know, trying for a better form of life. So I've gone back several times and caught up with the people on my street. And, you know, everybody complains about how terrible the economy is, but the people are actually doing quite well. One of the little boys from wartime is now a Calvin Klein underwear model.
Wow.
almost all the kids I know now speak English and are doing pretty well.
Hmm. What about getting back into North Korea? Do you have any illusions of getting back in there after you've written this book?
I hope to get back. I don't feel that my book was oddly as critical as some. I think I portrayed the people with dignity. And I certainly hope I can go back. I'm still passionately interested in North Korea. I'm China correspondent now, but I want to see how things develop under the new leader, and you know, I'm hoping that everyday life will improve.
You know, your book ends in 2010, is of course before Kim Jong-il had died. The people were preparing for the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, and there was, I guess, the sense of hope, I guess, that things were getting better. And you wrote at the time in your book this, you wrote, "I can do the math. It's only 2 years away, and I wonder how it can possibly get better when people are starving now." So how do you assess the conditions in North Korea today?
Well, things really have not gotten better. You know, it's funny, a lot of the events in my book take place in the 90s, but when I've been more recently to the North Korean border traveling from China, and I talk to mostly women coming out, their lives are the same. They're eating corn porridge once or twice a day. They don't know where their next meal is coming from. They're watching relatives die of starvation. It's really not a lot better. Mm. I mean, I remain hopeful that under the new leadership, the Kim Jong-un, who is Kim Jong-il's youngest son, he's only in his late 20s, took over late last year. And I'm hoping just as a new face, he'll be better able to open up his country to foreign investment. And he doesn't have the political baggage of Kim Jong-il. He's not going to be hauled up before a tribunal on crimes against humanity because he hasn't been in long enough to do much.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're always looking for little signs that something might be happening. But, you know, the last I've spoken to people, they're always on the edge of starvation. They're not dying out in the streets the way they were in the 1990s, but they're still dying of, you know, diseases caused by acute malnutrition.
Hmm. Less than a minute here, but there have been these predictions time after time after time that people figure that there's an imminent collapse coming, but the propaganda is so powerful. At some point, do you think things will change? I mean, that the facade will finally crumble?
I do, and I think it could happen very soon. I would not assume that it would be like an East German style, Romania style collapse where the whole system falls apart. But I think if they play their cards right, they might be able to open up a bit with a controlled economy. I wouldn't have said that a few years ago, but seeing China's success and the support China is giving North Korea, I think it's possible.
Barbara Demick, she's the author of the book Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. She'll be at Brigham Young University this Thursday. Go to our website for the particulars. Barbara, thanks very much for the time.
Okay, thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.